This is Jane Poulin with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission interviewing Bob Lighton from the Brookings Institution. Also with me from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is Jeff Smith. And the topic we're going to discuss is the role of accounting or anomalies about accounting during the financial crisis. And Bob, with that introduction, I really just want to throw the time open to you to share with us any observations that you have about accounting, how it may have impacted things during the financial crisis, or how there may have been things about accounting that were highlighted because of what we went through during the crisis.
Right. Okay, so this is a very difficult topic, as you know. I think this is a religious question. because I've read the literature on both sides, and I've contributed a little bit of it to myself. I guess my initial reaction, I think, when the crisis happened, is I was sympathetic and still am sympathetic with those who say that it may have been a mistake to quote mark to market securities where there was no real market price, or where essentially people were or where the market price was essentially a liquidation price. And in the early days of the crisis, I know the standard argument has been that that by forcing banks to mark to market the CDOs and other complex mortgage securities when there was a very thin market, sort of led to a vicious cycle downward, impaired their capital. As they impaired their capital, banks tightened up. That made things worse, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So I am very sympathetic to that argument. At the same time, I've read the accountants, on the other hand, and there are a number of pieces out there. I think probably some of the best pieces, and you may find them on the Internet, and if not, we can talk further.
Yeah, if you have any to refer me to, certainly I've picked up some stuff, but I want to. If you have some that you'd recommend, I definitely would like to know what those are.
Yeah, so I think the best literature on this, there's a professor of accounting at the University of Chicago named Christian Leutz, L-E-U-Z.
Yes, I have that paper. I have that paper.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best paper on this.
It's a co-authored, two last names, L.
Yeah, Ray Ball, right? And so, I mean, there are other papers out there from the accounting profession and people defending the accounting, but I think Christian's article is probably the best. And basically, the thrust of the accountant's position is, look, as it turns out, those securities that were thinly traded, they went to hell anyhow. Frankly, marking them to market probably was more accurate than certainly using historical accounting or probably anything else the banks could have made up.
Right.
He makes a very good, a very good opposing argument. So I really sort of am in the middle on this, in the sense that the market was actually proved right. I said, "Let me put you on hold one quick second. My wife calling, but I'm going to tell her I have a call. Hold on a minute."
The lefty thing. I need more room than I've given you. Sorry. Is that better?
That's great. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, I think about this sort of from the angle of how would I fix this, and then maybe I'll work our way back to whether these things caused it, because there are really two things going on here. One is what accounting rules should you use And secondly, what capital standards should use. And basically, I think most people here would agree that we want the capital system to be, in a sense, countercyclical, so that whatever the accounting rules are, we don't want them to force the vicious cycle downward. And you can either accomplish that objective by essentially, allowing more freedom for banks to do accounting and not forcing them to stick to mark-to-market, or you can say, look, we're going to be real hard on mark-to-market accounting, but we're going to have a different set of capital standards that will be countercyclical, and then the standards will go looser in really bad times. Mm-hmm. So really the question becomes, do you use accounting standards to introduce that flexibility, or do you use capital standards to use that to introduce that flexibility? Because I don't know of anybody, even Christian Lloyds and other people who want to stick to the really hard position accounting, I don't know of many people now who want to say that we want to have inflexible accounting standard, capital standards, regardless of the economic condition of the banking system and the economy. Because I think we've all learned that you can get positive feedback loops of forcing banks to shrink their capital in bad times. Mm-hmm. And so I end up sort of coming down with let's probably be really tough on accounting and probably stick to mark-to-market accounting, but then have countercyclical capital standards that give us more flexibility. If we can't get those capital standards, those more flexible capital standards, then I would be probably more sympathetic with the view that I started with and where a lot of the critics of mark-to-market accounting are, like Bill Isaac and other people, who say, well, let's get the flexibility through accounting standards. So one way or another, we need more flexibility in the system because we don't want to have these positive, negative, or these negative feedback loops once the economy goes to hell.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, certainly there's been a lot written on this, and I've heard views from other folks as well. But let me just ask you a few follow-up questions. So certainly if you asked the FASB, currently they are wedded to the concept statements that they write their accounting standards by, and that's what leads them to believe that fair value is the best measure for transparency in financial reporting. So kind of there, if you say, okay, that's going to be a given, so I'm not really going to get a lot of movement on fair value. I doubt if the FASB would retreat from fair value and move more to a historical cost for financial instruments. It's just not the trend that the FASB has been following for the last decade or more. At least the last decade has been quite clear. And then the other complexity with the capital standards, at least currently, is I understand the capital standards, whether you look at the Fed standards or the OCC standards or maybe the OTS, I'm not as familiar with theirs, that their standards require that the regulatory balance sheet and income statement, which is the start point for determining regulatory capital standards, has to be US GAAP or at least as restrictive as U.S. GAAP.
Right.
And what you're arguing is something less restrictive than U.S. GAAP, I think. So it sounds like if we take the FASB writing rules that require fair value accounting as a given, then the solution is a change in kind of the regulatory rules and the philosophy about how regulatory capital is determined.
Right.
It have to divorce itself from U.S. GAAP, at least in regards to this issue.
Okay, well, let me be more precise about that, because what I'm trying to say is, because you're saying it more precisely, there are two ways to depart from the way we used to be. We can either go to accounting rules that are not U.S. GAAP, and we're back to RAP, regulatory management.
Right, and we've been down that path some time ago.
And we've been down that path, and that's got very bad connotations to it.
Yep. So we converge, and now we are where we are.
Okay, or you can go to a different system of capital standards. So in other words, stick to the FASB tough mark-to-market accounting, but go to a different system of capital standards that basically say, you know, instead of the minimum standard being 6, it's now 4, you know.
Oh, I see. In these cyclical downturns, you would allow for a lower capital.
So
oh,
I
see.
And most of the economists that I hang around with, basically, if they could wave a magic wand, they would say, and by the way, I'm not in favor, by the way, of immediately imposing higher capital standards on banks now in the middle of the downturn or even in the early stages of recovery. I think once we get further along the recovery, you know, we need higher capital standards all across the board. I think most economists that I talk to would say, look, let's introduce a system of countercyclical capital standards that are allowed to go down in bad times, but the floor, the very bottom capital standard, should be no lower than sort of where we used to be. So we ought to think about raising.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
We ought to think about raising the good times capital standard to, let's say, 8%, and having the bad times capital standard be 6%. But for God's sake, let's don't go below 6%. So I could see a future world in 5 years where we have a new higher standard of 8, and it goes down to 6 in a worst case. But I still stick to GAAP, because of all the bad connotations I have with RAP, and also another argument for not moving to RAP is that the markets don't give it any credibility. You know, it's not just, you know, average people and policymakers or whatever that sort of make fun of RAP. It's just investors, if they believe that, I mean, they don't give any credence to RAP. I mean, investors are probably going to trade on their assessment of market value regardless. And so, really, the question is, what's the minimum capital standard that we're going to require, not the accounting standard?
So then, if I step back from what you just said, if we had this mechanism in place during the crisis, all of the banks would have had more capital going into the crisis.
Correct.
We would have still had the same pro-cyclicality, if you argue that, you know, that was exacerbated by mark-to-market accounting. We still would have had a decrease in the amount of capital actually at these banks. So you'd still have those downward trends. It's just they wouldn't have been so severe to perhaps necessitate government intervention? Or they wouldn't have been so severe to cause further spiraling?
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, this crisis was so severe that I'm not sure that even the countercyclical capital requirement that I'm talking about, let's say going from 8 to 6, would have made all that much difference. It would have made some, but the reality is that given the severity of this crisis, this wiped out enough capital on the banks, at least on the balance sheets of the large banks, that it would have put a lot of them in trouble, even if we had a regime going from 8 to 6, because the Citigroups of the world were probably, you know, on a mark-to-market basis down at 2 or 3,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's why we ended up putting TARP money into them. In fact, some people may believe that you know, on a mark-to-market basis, at one point Citigroup and maybe some others were actually negative capital. So I think even a countercyclical standard. Hold on, let me just quickly answer this. Bob, hold on. Hi, it's Bob. Hi, I'm currently on a phone call. Can you call me back about an hour? Okay, bye bye. Sorry. So I think this kind of countercyclical system I'm suggesting is probably useful for quote normal crises, but it's not useful for the huge. You know, 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 year event of the kind that we had now. And by the way, the reason I say it's 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 year, I'm not going to say it's a 1 in 100 year, because unfortunately these things happen too often. I don't know exactly what could have prevented the severity of this crisis. And so, for example, even if Bill Isaac were running the world, and let's say we had abandoned mark-to-market accounting. And not use GAAP, I think this crisis would have been damn bad anyhow. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's a good place for me to pose another thought. So financial institutions trade things that are on their balance sheet, and they enter into financial transactions every day. The periodic financial statements that companies file are only filed once a quarter, and they're right. anywhere from, you know, 30 to 45 days after the period ends. So they're dated once they're finally released.
Right.
So I'm confused when people argue the pro-cyclicality of mark-to-market accounting, because that impacts financial statements that come out four times a year, which are dated when they're actually released. And these financial institutions are entering into transactions on a daily basis, which are based on pricing of current trades. So it feels to me like does it really matter what's on the financial statements if they come out at the times they do and it, as dated as they do, when these financial institutions are having to manage cash flow and liquidity on literally a daily basis, and they are in the midst of, during the crisis, delevering and going into the marketplace and exploring what the prices would be for the transactions that they're trying to either enter into, exit from, and is it that activity that's really causing the pro-cyclicality in the actual trades that then show up later on in the financial statements when they're actually produced? And even if you had historical cost on the investments that are printed on the financial statements that are actually printed, wouldn't market participants realize that because the trades are occurring at lower and lower values, that they would derive their own kind of fair value capital amount?
Yeah, okay, tell me, interpret what you're saying. You're saying that traders see through all this, right?
Well, I'm saying that market participants, they have, the traders see through it. I mean, the traders aren't...
What you're saying is that market participants, they trade, they buy and sell Citigroup based on their market, their perception of the market value of Citigroup right now. So almost regardless of what the rule writers are saying, the market is busy, you know, either discounting or marking up the value of the stock based on, and the debt, the same thing, the subordinated debt, the same thing.
Well, I just don't think that they, I mean, they get information when those periodic filings occur, but I don't think that their daily trades are dependent upon a set of financial statements that was released a month ago, which is 2.5 months old. I just think they have more current information upon which they trade.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So anybody who's buying and selling Citigroup today, you're right, will not. I mean, it's true they'll look at the financial statement a month ago, but if in the intervening month the mortgage market has gone to hell and they know that Citigroup has a bunch of mortgages on its portfolio, mm-hmm. they're already implicitly going to mark Citigroup down.
Right. So if they know that they're holding RMBS and the mortgage market is falling out, and they know
that RMBS is trading lower than it used to be.
Yeah, they're going to impute some sort of haircut on what would have been historical cost if the argument is we don't use fair value but we use historical cost.
And so to translate what you're saying, look, the real constraint on these banks' behavior is not the regulators, it's the market, at least for publicly traded companies.
Say that again, the constraint on...
What you're saying is that the real constraint on the behavior of publicly traded banks is really the market, not the regulators. And, I mean, you're making an argument that in a way that the debate over mark-to-market doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a SEC reporting, and U.S. GAAP is the ultimate. But there are participants in the marketplace who use lots of other data to make decisions.
Yes.
And I think some of that is because the information that comes out in the periodic filings is dated. So if it's dated and you set it aside because it's dated and it only gives some level of historical indication of, you know, the picture of this company at a point in time, then for trading purposes, does it matter if those assets are at historical or some other value? Because if they're of historical value, I'm gonna adjust for it anyway. It's just that if the last time the financial statements came out, the assets are on the balance sheet at fair value, I'm only going to have to adjust for the diminution in value between that date and now, as opposed to all the way back to when the cost came on the balance sheet.
Yeah, no, that's all true.
So it's a transparency thing from a financial reporting perspective. And again, if knowing that the financial statements are dated, our users and our participants in the market, are they better off knowing what the last fair value marks were at a period end and taking into consideration the other factors that have changed since then to get a read on, you know, where is Citi in terms of, for example, or any other company, where are they in terms of value in the market today?
Okay, so here's my reaction to this. I'm thinking out loud as I go. You know, the market does react to public statements. All right?
Yeah.
So it's true that investors today are guessing how badly Citigroup got hit by the mortgage disaster. But they don't know exactly how bad. They know it's bad. They make inferences from, you know, certain thinly traded indexes or whatever other information is out there, and the analysts are busy crunching their numbers and they make guesses. But if somebody official comes out with a number that looks like it's more precise, then markets do react to that. Okay?
Right.
So, I guess the real question is, suppose Citigroup, when they come out with their number, instead of using a quote mark-to-market number, which is based on some thinly traded index, suppose they use some other number, maybe not historical cost, but it's some other judgmental number about, you know, how bad their loan losses are going to be, but it's not tied specifically to a market number. If they put that out, the market's reaction to that will depend entirely on how much confidence they have in the integrity of Citigroup's financial reporting process.
That's why financial reporting people are all about transparency.
Bingo.
Because if the financial information is not transparent, market participants will have more anxiety. They will make adjustments, yes. And even if their adjustment was 100% spot on to what it would have been if you'd used an alternative, more transparent methodology of reporting, it still introduces anxiety into the marketplace.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you're absolutely right. And so I think, let me put it this way, in an environment in which the world's falling apart, market participants are going to be inherently more suspicious and less trustworthy of anybody reporting anything that is not tied to some kind of market value number.
Right. And even the mark to model, anything that's fair value but is not an actual live trade.
Yeah, they won't trust models either.
They get anxious about that stuff, too.
They'll be anxious about that. In good times, they'll trust them because it doesn't matter. But when the shit hits the fan, so to speak, you're right, no one's going to trust anybody unless it's anchored to a specific number that at least has some trading, you know, behind it. And I guess what we're collectively saying here is that, you know, imagine, again, I use Bill Isaac only because he's written so widely that this was such a disaster. Imagine he were king throughout this crisis, and he were, and we followed his rules, and all the banks were reporting, look, we're only going to lose 10 cents on the dollar. And meanwhile, the very thinly traded indexes are saying they're going to lose 50 cents on the dollar. Investors probably would have blown right through the 10-cent estimates and have said, you know, you guys don't know what you're talking about. And they would have blobbered the banks anyhow.
Yeah. So that, but that speaks to individual institution, say, stock and bond values. But in
right.
terms of the pro-cyclicality of, say, you know, broad-based securities that are held by these institutions, the dealing with daily trades, I don't know as though it really matters to a trader at Goldman what Citigroup reported their RMBS portfolio as of the last balance sheet date. I think it matters to Goldman when they're trading RMBS what the last trade of RMBS with the same types of characteristics and vintage traded at. So the pro-cyclicality of, say, RMBS and other securities that aren't the securities of the financial institutions, their individual stocks and bonds, I don't know as though that pro-cyclicality is impacted even as much as, the stock of Citigroup would be from fair value accounting. That seems even more tied to the daily activity.
Yeah, well, that's all true.
Yeah. Because what's on the balance sheets of these financial institutions aren't the stocks and bonds of other financial institutions so much as it is the mortgage-backed and various other asset-backed securities that they were having to write down because the mortgages were faltering.
Right.
Anyway, this was supposed to be you telling me, not me trying to convince you of an alternative view, but...
I wanted to
test my hypothesis in those areas to see if you thought that they had any validity.
Well, they do. They do. They do. And the only thing I'm going to add, this is all very useful. Again, the only reason that we're having this conversation is because I have no firm views on this because this is a very complicated subject. And I don't think at the end of the day there's any right or wrong. I mean, it's hard to know what the right or wrong answer is. But... let me just, though, address the subject, independent of what the stock and bond markets say about the value of Citigroup stock. Let's ask ourselves the question, does it affect Citigroup's behavior what the regulators say their capital is? Okay?
Okay.
I want to pose that question because...
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
So I want to say, independent of whatever the stock or bond market reaction is to Citigroup, and I'm using Citigroup only apocryphally here, whatever the market reaction is, the question is, does it matter to Citigroup's behavior what the regulators say their capital is? Okay? And the answer to that, I think, is yes, it does. Especially under the prompt corrective action regime, where they know that their regulatory capital, which we will assume right now is measured at GAAP, as their regulatory capital falls, they're subject to progressively stiffer sanctions. And so if we have a system. And I'm just trying to make Bill. I'm trying to make Bill Isaac's argument, all right. And I want to test it to see whether there's truth to it. He would say that if we apply mark-to-market accounting, and that causes Citigroup's reported capital to go from 8% to 4%, that is going to put them below the regulatory minimum of 6, and that's going to impose all kinds of draconian things on Citigroup.
Oh, so okay. Citigroup will delever more.
They'll delever to get
the capital up.
Bingo. They'll sell assets. They won't make as many loans. And when everybody behaves like that, it feeds a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
That's his argument. All right? And our conversation up to now is they may have behaved that way anyhow because of the stock market reaction or the bond market reaction. You know, that the threat of regulatory sanctions may have added no extra downward force, let us say, to Citigroup's behavior, than what was already being supplied by the market. I mean,
Yeah, and Citi is an interesting example that you chose because there are mixed views about whether people were really looking at the regulatory capital if they were looking at other measures of capital.
Yeah, and so I don't know. I mean, this is an empirical question. Do bank managers behave, what do they react to? Do they react to only market measures, or does the fear of the regulators add some additional element to their, you know, a fright to their behavior?
Mm-hmm.
So, and the argument of the people who claim that that accounting contributed to the crisis, I think we're implicitly assuming that the fear of the regulators was an additional force that caused them to, okay, you know, become more conservative.
So
they have to make,
right, so
they have to make that assumption.
Yeah, their connection is through capital.
Right.
Yeah, that is the downward pressure on the total asset side that causes,
right,
the downward pressure on their capital in order to maintain the expected either regulatory or market perceptions of capital levels that should be maintained, they're going to delever.
Right. Right. And
the belief,
you know,
would be
actually
people,
huh,
won't, the belief would be people will not adjust for the thing I said, that they'll adjust because they know that that's not really the capital. That's a kind of a capital that includes, in the extreme, assets carried at historical costs that are currently trading at 20 cents on the dollar.
Right. But I will tell you that I think the whole of the literature that's in the banking area, I think there is an implicit assumption that, I don't know, you know, now that we're talking about it, I don't know if it's ever been verified in conversations with bankers, but there is an implicit assumption in the literature that bank management does pay a lot of attention to what, you know, the regulatory capital is. And if they're really below the level, or they fear being below the minimum because then all kinds of bad things happen to them.
Yeah, I would take that as a given. I wouldn't need to validate that. But I mean, I don't think any of these banks want to even approach the minimum. So
right,
that they get you, right? Yeah.
Right.
Because bad things happen.
But you know what? I mean, even though it seems so obvious to us, and it is obvious to us in good times, you don't want to be singled out as the one bad bank and then be punished by the regulators. You know, you look terrible and you get clobbered. I'm not so sure it's true when the world's falling apart. When the world's falling apart and the market is clobbering stock, I'm not sure how much additional fear the regulators are giving you when already the world's already full of fear. You follow me?
Yeah.
And so
you have a liquidity issue regardless of what the capital requirements are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like the regulators are surpluses. Who gives a damn? You're in deep trouble anyhow. And so in this world, things are going to hell. It may be that mark-to-market or whatever the accounting rules are don't make any difference, because investors out there are implicitly applying mark-to-market assessments. And in a bad state of the world, it may not make any difference.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a hypothesis that I have just thought of.
Yeah.
And it may well be true, by the way.
It's kind of hard to measure when you're in that situation. Is it an additional straw on the camel's back or not? Or is it,
trying to bail out the water of the boat here.
Right, exactly. One additional hole doesn't
honestly,
make much difference.
I think if you were to ask a CEO of any one of these large banks that got into trouble this question, honestly, I'm not sure that some of them would say, look, you know, the regulatory standards were sort of extraneous to us. We're getting clobbered. The world's falling apart, you know. And in that sense, now, on the other hand, the institutions were all out there at the time vigorously protesting the mark-to-market accounting rules.
Yeah. I think this may be in the paper that you referred to. Not all of the assets of banks are at fair value. Loans are.
No.
though. But
I think it was probably the what I refer to as mark to model. So anything that was certainly level three or level two type of assets.
Right. Exactly.
And I think there might have been some unresolved implementation issues early on with FAS 157, so that
there
were some oddities that were occurring, communications between auditors and the audited firms that may have fostered the clamoring about fair value accounting.
Right.
But anyway, did you have to go ahead?
Yeah, Bob, this is Jeff Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to ask you quickly, is your alternative hypothesis an alternative basis for, I guess, what you would call flexible capital standards in the wake of a crisis?
The flexible capital standards only make sense if you believe that even in the midst of a crisis, the capital standards still have some, I mean, they matter.
Oh, yeah, okay.
All right.
And what you're saying is in a time of crisis, they don't really matter.
They may not matter.
They may not matter because there's too many other things going on. There's too much water coming in the boat other ways.
Yeah, and so I think the flexible accounting standards, the flexible countercyclical accounting standards, I mean, the capital standards, are probably, as I said, they're only useful for what I would call sort of a normal crisis. like, I'll give you an example. Sort of like the recession in 2000-2001. You know, things were bad, but the banking system wasn't going to hell. You probably had a few banks that were going under, you know. You could apply a flexible account capital standard regime in that world, and it probably would, you know, help at the margin of preventing, you know, some vicious cycle downward effects. But what I'm positing is that I'm not even sure that, you know, that in a crisis we had in 2000 or 2008, the kind of regime I'm talking about would have made much difference.
Yeah. I mean, it might have at the margins.
The margin.
Yeah.
But, you know, the big banks that went under, you know, Wachovia and WaMu or whatever, they would have gone under anyhow. Right?
Yeah.
It didn't matter. They were so deeply underwater, they were in trouble anyhow.
So it wouldn't have really mattered for them.
It wouldn't have really mattered, you know.
Because they would have blown through the floor.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to talk to Bill Isaac.
Oh, he'll give you an earful.
Okay.
I hope to understand his views better. Huh?
I hope to understand his views better. I'm sure there's pieces I don't understand yet, and that'll be very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing you got to push back on him on is what makes you believe that the market is basically going to essentially ignore all the other evidence that the world is falling to hell, and are going to believe your numbers instead.
The regulatory capital numbers.
Yeah, and you know, if you've created this parallel universe and the markets don't believe you, and they're driving all these stocks to hell, the banks could still pull in their horns, and because you know, as you said, they're having liquidity problem, you can have your other world accounting standards, but they don't matter. So, I mean, that's the question he has to answer.
Okay.
I'm sure he'll have an answer for it. So,
any other areas of accounting? If there's more on fair value or mark to market?
No, I think this is about it.
Yeah. And other areas, you think?
No, I think this is pretty much the scope of the dispute.
Okay.
I mean, this is a hard section of the report to write, so.
Well, it's lots of different views. This is research, so.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily to reach a conclusion so much as to lay out alternative views,
lay out the views so far. But as I said, at the end of the day, I feel more comfortable, regardless of whatever the causes are, I feel more comfortable thinking that I think despite all the disagreements between the capital people and the accounting people, at the end of the day, I think most people would at least want some more flexibility in the regulatory treatment of banks on the way down than we had before. And as I said, you can either do it through the accounting standards or do it through the capital standards.
Yeah.
But I think most people will be in play for flexibility. Now, there may be a small minority of people who say, I'm opposed to flexibility. Oh, by the way, I should finish by saying this. I think the economists that I hang around with would not be in favor of a system that has too much discretion to it on the flexibility. In a sense, I think they would feel more comfortable if let's say we had an 8% standard in good times and a 6% standard in bad times, that there would be very clear criteria of when you go from 8% to 6%. I was going to say people would get uncomfortable if the decision to move from an 8% floor to a 6% floor is entirely subjective, and would sort of, you know, we just leave it to the regulators to say, well, you know, they'll do it in their best judgment. That would make people nervous. I think you need sort of objective triggers for moving from a good state of the world to a bad state of the world.
And presumably we crossed one of those triggers during the crisis.
Right.
Yeah.
You may not have to spell them all out in statute. You may have 3 or 4 or 5 different criteria, you know, like GDP, unemployment, you know, make up some other numbers. But whatever it is, you know, I think you ought to have some objective criteria moving from one state, because I think a lot of people would be very nervous about a capital regime where basically the Fed or the controller just simply says, we'll just, you know, it's sort of like systemic risk. We know it when we see it. And people would get comfortable with too much discretion. I mean, uncomfortable with too much discretion. So I want to, because then it's just like having too much discretion in the accounting world too. People are afraid of too much discretion.
Yeah. So to me, if there's too much discretion, people don't understand, and it's even if people understand what the triggers are, there's no real way of telling why a bank is not at 6, but it's now at 4.5, and it's still above the trough requirement of 4. But why did it go from 6 to 4.5? Is that all mark-to-market accounting?
Yeah.
Or is it because they got, you know, bad loans, which isn't a mark-to-market accounting issue?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So originally I was thinking they would be able to migrate down to that lower capital requirement, but only for mark-to-market accounting items. Like you'd adjust the capital measure by adding back the mark-to-market accounting items for the periods in which you're allowing this lower capital.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That's sort of like a halfway house, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You get to be in the regulatory halfway house because of mark-to-market accounting for whichever quarters you hit the triggers, or the market hits the triggers, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, because you were thinking market triggers versus I was thinking maybe individual institutions.
Yeah.
And you're thinking that for everybody, the minimum would drop to 4.
Right, exactly. That's what I was thinking. And by the way, a variation of what you're saying is it could be everybody, but I'm only going to do it for mark-to-market adjustments. And I'm not going to lower the floor at 4% for, you know, if you lose money on,
real estate owned. I don't know.
Real estate owned or whatever. I mean, this gets tricky to sort of only do it for some items and not for others.
Yeah, it's like you'd have a secondary capital measure.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd have the regular capital measure.
Yeah.
And then you'd have the capital measure added back.
Yeah, most of the people who talk about countercyclical capital standards are not getting that fine.
Yeah.
They're just thinking about it across the board. I go from 6 to 4, you know, period.
And
not make it.
Yeah, the only reason I raise it is because if a bank is allowed to go to the trough standard for things other than mark-to-market accounting, and that's kind of the premise upon which we're instituting this trough standard. If banks are allowed to go to the to only meet the trough standard, capital standard, and it can be that they're at that level for reasons other than mark-to-market accounting, I'm not sure if that doesn't introduce additional anxiety into the market.
Yeah, it probably does.
Because we're trying to do this for mark-to-market, but if you're telling me that any bank can go there for any reason, including mark-to-market accounting, but including other things, then I may react to that by saying, well, really, the trough standard is the standard that applies all the time, really.
Right.
I should just bank on the trough standard.
Right.
I don't know. It's an interesting alternative, though, I think, the trough standard.
Yeah.
What I'm calling the trough standard of the flexible capital requirements.
Well, really, the non-trough standard is really just basically an extra cushion during good times.
I'm going
to force you to have a larger cushion you would otherwise do, but it's really the bad time standard that's the standard. It's really the true.
The true standard, and the other is just a way to have more cushion.
To jack up capital in good times to make sure I got more of a cushion.
Yeah, you have a cushion going into tough times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It makes sense.
Yeah. It does. So, and you're right, if you establish the trough standard as the standards that are required now, and the good time standard would be higher than that.
Right.
That would achieve that goal, that there would be more cushion going into tough times.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay?
Okay.
All righty. Good luck, you guys.
All right. Great. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.